Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. My name is Sam Otten from the University of Missouri, and my guest is Dr. Natalie Sinclair, who's a professor at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, Canada. Natalie, thanks so much for being here.
It's a pleasure, Sam. Thanks for inviting me.
We are going to be talking about a recent article by Natalie in the journal Digital Experiences in Mathematics Education, and the article is entitled Knowing as Remembering: Methodological Experiments in Embodied Experiences of Number. So, Natalie, this article is an interesting one where you're trying out some ideas, kind of taking them for a spin around the block is kind of how I thought about it and seeing how they play out. And you are trying to challenge a couple things that are pretty pervasive in math education and education research more broadly. So I want to start with some of those big ideas, and they're ones that you kind of then reinterpret through this article. So the two big ideas I want to start with are transcripts, written transcripts of interactions and dialogue and speech. And then the other big idea is a very big idea about the mind-body duality from philosophy and from thinking about how we experience this world. And so I want to just start with your views on transcripts and mind-body duality, and then how do you see those as, you know, important ideas in math education?
Okay, great. Well, just starting with transcripts then, since that's sort of where the paper starts, I do want to make sure readers don't ever come away from this, or readers, listeners, sorry, thinking that I am against transcripts because I'm not. And I think I say in the paper that how much I think that we've learned from them, and really that it depends on what it is that your research question is. And that for my work, I find that transcripts, I wonder in the article, and this is what I'm exploring, how much they have gotten in the way of being able to share, express, study some of the more embodied aspects of doing mathematics. And since my work involves using digital technology, where I'm trying to actually support those kinds of specific body movements, that matters to me. So that made me think a little bit about transcripts and where they come from, why we use them, why they are so pervasive. Nobody sort of wonders, am I going to use a transcript? They just use a transcript. And, you know, we have formats for them in our conference papers and so on. So they're really significant. And they existed before we had video. And even before we had audio recording, people would use transcripts. And so in a way, they maybe haven't caught up fully with some of the new technologies that we have for doing research. So I started looking at it a little bit and thinking about transcripts in the way that, even though people have done really brilliant work in trying to embellish, let's say, transcripts from just being about text to trying to express things about actions and even emotions, just the way they're set out, they visually sort of separate out these different aspects of experience. And I think as human beings, when we act in the world in this very podcast we're doing, I'm not thinking like there's what I say, and then there's how I move my hands, and then there's the tone of voice. It's all like one thing. And so the fact that transcripts separate that out, I think, operates in a certain way, which, depending on your research question, could be exactly what you want, but is not what I wanted. I was looking to think about how to bring these aspects of experience together, highlight the way they're intertwined. I think the other thing is that transcripts often, and they don't have to, but the way we use them, they separate out the human actors. In my work with technology, I'm really interested in how the technology is actually an actor, but other things can be actors as well. And that comes out of Bruno Latour's work in actor network theory. And then they sort of impose a certain temporality. You know, we have the different line numbers, and it's hard to get away from thinking that this all happened in linear, equally spaced chunks. We know it's not like that, but it's just the format of the transcript that sort of, you know, strongly suggests that.
And it also makes me think too about like the pacing, because when I'm actually talking to people, to me, the pacing is a big thing that I'm kind of monitoring. Like I have kind of a fast pace. Other people that I work with also have a fast pace, so we can kind of get on the same wavelength. But then other people have a more medium pace or even a slower pace. But in a transcript, they're just written down word after word after word, right? So you can't really tell, wow, there was a pace shift here, or this person is, you know, kind of tends to speak in a different speed than others. That's all just flattened to write the words down that they said.
Yeah, exactly. So those were things that I noticed about transcripts after thinking about like the what are other things we could be doing to share our research. So this paper we're talking about today is really not about sort of how you do research necessarily, but the business we have of communicating amongst ourselves and how we do that and how that's, and our current technologies for doing that.
But then you bring in mind body and you sort of also challenge that a little bit, or you bring some of your own perspectives to rejecting the duality or the separation of mind and body. So you want to set the stage a little bit on that one?
Yeah, so that work goes back quite a bit further. I mean, since 2001, I've been very interested in body cognition and exploring, first with Lakoff and Nunez, sort of assumptions about the role of the body in mathematical thinking. And then with Elizabeth de Freitas in our book of 2014, Mathematics and the Body, we really tried to rethink the implications first of the separation of mind-body, and then what are other ways we can imagine thinking about human action and in relation to mathematics. Lots has been said about poor Descartes, who like sets up this mind-body distinction. It's not so much distinctions that matter because we use them all the time and they can be useful, but it's the implications of them. So in the case of Descartes, it wasn't just there's mind and body, but there was the implicit hierarchy of mind is actually where all the interesting things happen, and the body, the more we can get rid of it, the better. And we see this play out in so many ways in our society, but in math education, I remember being told by a senior math educator, you gesture too much when you're giving a talk. That's not serious. It's like you're not objective enough, and so on. So these are like what would you call them? Like hangover effects of making a just that binary in the first place, and then hierarchizing one of them. And we do that a lot with lots of other concepts that run wild also in our work. So male, female, able-bodied, disabled, all of these things that create that distinction and then create the normative proper, more important way of being, in which case you read everything else in terms of that thing. So trying to disrupt that mind body is partly trying to look for ways in which we can talk about the body knowing, or different ways in which so that it's not something that just sort of happens in the mind or something. For me, that's a lot really paying attention to what is actually happening, what are the actions, what are the what's the feeling, what's the senses that are at play. And that's another thing about transcripts, since they're always bringing you to words, then we get sort of like all enchant. I love words too, just as much as everybody else, and they kind of enchant you into thinking that things are objectified or schematized or all of these other things that are basically magical things that happen in the mind. So for a long time, Liz and I have been trying to rethink methodology, actually, and there's a lot of work, obviously, in qualitative methodology circles of people doing really interesting things there. And in my paper, I actually go back to very early Patti Lather work from the 90s, where she introduces these ideas of embodied validity and voluptuous validity before, like, we were talking about embodied cognition, to try to emphasize how important these aspects of experiences are and how difficult they are also to get into our current technologies of sharing research.
So I think you've touched on this, but I just want to ask for this article, how you see this article as the next step in your effort to challenge those ideas, work beyond those common ideas of mind-body duality or beyond transcripts. So, as you're talking about it here, I can, it's something you've been thinking about for a while. How do you see this article in Digital Experiences and of Math Education fitting into that effort?
Well, it was really around sort of two things. One is kind of minor and the other one a little bit more major. The minor thing was about how I wanted to really work with the idea of gesture as not just being this communicative act, which is how it gets framed in the literature that comes more mainly from linguistics and how it gets used a lot in math education. Not that that's not interesting. There's lots of research that has helped us understand the role of gestures in mathematical thinking. But there are also many of my colleagues who, when I talk about the gestures that happen when you're doing something on a computer screen, say, "Oh no, that's not gestures. That's just moving your hands." And that little word "just" is always like a big flag for me, because it's one of those words we use to say it's not as important as. So I'm interested in, because of the work that I'm doing on, designing technologies that encourage kids to use certain gestures, to look at how those movements of the hand on the screen change over time from being manipulative, epistemic, and actually reenactments of their own sometimes in remembering. So I needed something a little bit more continuous, as a way of thinking about gestures. So that was one thing that I really wanted to bring out. And then the reenactments really came out of long-standing difficulty that not just me, but a lot of people who work in technology have had, which is, if you try to describe in an article like what your technology does, I've worked for ages to describe like what dynamic geometry does. And what I realize is, like, people read it and they have no clue, actually, no matter how good I think my description is, until they do it themselves. Oh, that's what happens when you drag a triangle. Really simple thing, right? So that the importance, if I wanted people to understand the importance of actually touching the screen, having it touch you back, the movement, I'm gesturing away here, which our listeners won't be able to see, but the movement, the feedback, like all of that that you feel when you're actually doing it, it was going to be important for me to somehow get that across. And maybe, I'm not like the best sort of creative writer, so that wasn't going to be an option open to me. So the idea of actually getting people to do it themselves was sort of where the reenactments came from. And I don't think I talk about it so much in this paper, but it also came out of reading a book called Investigative Aesthetics, which is written by some forensic architects who actually do investigations at crime scenes by reenacting what was done, so people can like smell, what does a gunshot actually smell like? Can I smell it from 10 meters away? Can I smell it from 20 meters away? So it's not just collecting like interviews of what people said, but actually going to the senses as a source of empirical data. And so that's how that came about. And so it's, and like you said at the beginning, it's an experiment. I'm trying it out to see, like, readers actually even do it.
Well, I was going to say to me, it was unique, right? To get to that reenact. So we'll talk about it more later, but to get to this section where you ask the reader, try this, do this, move along with what the student is doing, with the mathematical thinking and stuff. And that's kind of unique to have a math education article that's asking the reader, no, please play this out. You have to sort of get into it. Just now, when you're talking about the mind body and, Descartes and the mathematics side of it, it makes me think of my graduate mathematics textbooks, where it will say, like, pause and try to prove this little lemma or something, on your own. Or it will say, try this problem before you go to the next part. So it's also like a stop, and the reader has to do it before you proceed. But it's very mental. It's like, it's make sure that you, as the reader, think through this mathematical reasoning or this mathematical problem before you proceed to the next part of the text. Whereas yours was physical, like yours was try these motions, do this kind of interaction. So it was mind and body together instead of just think through something.
Right.
But we'll get into that more. Before we do that, though, just tell us a little bit about touch counts and make sure that we have that little bit of context.
Okay, so Touch Counts is a multi-touch app that Nicholas Jockeef and I developed 2014 as well, I think. So it's a app that we developed for early number sense, so usually 3 to 8 years old. It's free on iPads. And it was really to mobilize the power of the fingers to allow students to basically go beyond 10, which is the limit of their numbers of fingers. I can't say that it was based exclusively on research that I did by reading all the literature beforehand, but as we went along, we learned actually how important the fingers are in learning number. And, you know, that the place in the brain right next to number sense is your fingers, and they're very close, and that it's sort of not an accident. And that actually developing a sense of your own fingers, that you have fingers and they're distinct, co-evolves for many kids with number sense. So we were really focusing on the deployment of numbers, and also in enabling kids to connect that touch and the gesture with the symbols and the numbers, the number names as well. So again, you know, we inherit this Brunnerian idea that there's these levels, that first it's sensory motor, and then it's iconic, and then it's abstract or whatever, symbolic. And what we can do with technology now is actually put it all together so that you're not going through these stages, but the kid is, you know, pressing three fingers down, which anybody can do, hearing three at the same time and seeing that symbol three, and having a visual feedback of threeness as well. So we, you know, called that one-to-one-to-one-to-one correspondence of bringing all of those senses to play. So it has two worlds. One is very ordinal, which we are very interested in, because most of the way the curriculum in the United States and in Canada is framed around early number sense focuses on cardinality, on the question of how much. But a lot of research in neuroscience is showing now how important ordinality is for development of simple sense. And our interest in ordinality comes from some work by Caleb Gattegno and Dick Tata. So we really wanted to explore that. So in one world, you're really focusing on ordinality, and in another world, you create numbers, and then you can use gestures to add the numbers, subtract the numbers, even multiply and partition the numbers as a proto-division kind of thing, sort of all through specific gestures. So they sort of replace in some way the symbols that we use typically when we're writing mathematics.
And then in the article, there's a key video clip that becomes kind of the centerpiece of the article. So I wonder if you could just set the stage or give us a little context of that video clip.
Yeah, so we after we created Touch Counts, we wanted to translate it into different languages. And there was an opportunity to translate it into Ojibwe, which is a language of the First Nations people, actually that straddles Canada and the U.S., Ontario, and whatever the state is below Ontario.
Oh, Michigan. I know it touches Michigan because that's where I grew up and we had still the tribe there.
Right. Probably multiple states.
Like, yeah, yeah.
I was working with a group of colleagues on spatial reasoning development with a group of Indigenous kids who were in a Head Start program. And so wanted to sort of explore with them whether this was like even an app that was of interest to them before we started thinking about translating. So we were just as part of different activities that we were doing spatial reasoning and using touch counts. This video was taken. And so it wasn't like I was specifically engaged in researching this thing, but it just happened to be taken. And I was sent the video, you know, over 5 years ago. And it's, I think this probably happens to many researchers. There's, you know, that piece of data that you never actually got around to, and you know, it's important, but you don't really know why yet. And so I had just come out of 3 years of admin work and was really excited about the idea of having time again to do research and returned to that data. And with the support of Anna, the editor of DEME, just went to town on thinking about that. And it was just good timing because a lot of different things that I'd been reading came together and made that idea of reenactment possible in a way for me to see something about the video that I thought was interesting beyond, you know, the video itself.
All right. So getting into the article some more, we alluded to this before, but you give a narrative account of the video and sort of what's happening in it and the experiences in it. There's experiences, actions, you try to, in the narrative, sort of weave together both parts of the mind and body to sort of blur that distinction. And then you also provide what we talked about before, this reenactment kind of description, where you're asking the reader to sort of go along with you in reenacting it. And during that reenactment part, you do share some images of the video. So point the listeners to the article, and that will bring it to life more to be able to see some images from that video. But we have the audio format here, so we'll just keep pushing forward with the audio format. That's what we have to work with, and we just have our disembodied voices here. Could you just kind of talk us through the actual sort of play-by-play of what happens in this video clip?
Okay, so we're in the cardinal world where you can make what we call herds of numbers. So if you put one finger down, you make a one, but if you put three fingers down, you make a three. And she has made the little girl who's 4 years old has made two herds of two that are on the screen. I ask her what she thinks will happen if she puts them together. She, of course, like I know adults will say, oh, that's addition, but the girl doesn't know that. The girl just knows, like, within what we're doing that it's putting together. And she says, oh, it's going to be 22. And then she puts it together and sees that it's four and gets and you know that's not what she expected. So there's a reaction there. And so in the video clip, we basically do that over. She does it again, but now I'm asking her to do it again. And then I ask her how I would do it. So we sort of go through a similar set of actions four times, but where the intention is a little bit different each time. The narrative part was, you know, it's really hard to ask people to do a reenactment when they have no context at all for what is going on. So the narrative part really helped provide that context, so that when the reenactment When I invited the reenactment, there was like something meaningful to work with. I thought about asking people to just follow a set of instructions that I would give them that would be written, but they would take forever to actually say everything that, you know, how she's sitting, you know, where the iPad is, you know, relative to her, where I am relative to her, and all. So the image seemed to be like a really good way to capture a lot of that and get people more quickly to actually doing it themselves. And I even thought people could touch the iPad that's in the image in case they didn't have an iPad themselves. So the image operated in an interesting way there that I briefly mentioned, but I think is something that is interesting, which isn't not so much now a representation of what happened, but now it's kind of like a tool for you to use to make something new happen. And so it's like embodied cognition, but for the researcher instead of for the learner.
Right. Yeah, and I'll be curious, you know, how readers react to it or if they remember or connect with this article in a different way because it is engaging the reader in a new way, but that's kind of going beyond the article itself. But having looked at and thinking about this interaction that's represented in the video and then represented in this narrative and the reenactment, how did you interpret it then through this non-dualistic point of view, or how does this illustrate some of those big ideas that we set out at the beginning about breaking down mind body or thinking beyond transcripts sort of thing.
Yeah, so well, let me just say something because you used the word representation twice. You know, when we use the word representation, we're often what we bring to mind is that there is one thing that exists out there and we're copying it as best as we can. And I think what becomes obvious in the reenactment and even in the narrative is that every new description of what happened is a new thing. It isn't like a copy of something else, and so we change it. Even the most diehard objectivist, you know, researcher changes something even by virtue of putting it in a transcript, like as we talked before. So I don't see them so much as representations, but as, you know, recreations, reenactments. That then it's my job as a researcher to say why I think they're valuable. And you know, where the different sort of forms of validity might be.
It's a new thing itself, but it has some important similarities to this other thing over there in the past or something. And those similarities are important, but it actually has, you've created a new thing itself, or every time a reader does it, they've created a new one for themselves.
Which actually happens all the time. You know, anybody who reads a transcript, I think if you and I read the same transcript, we'd come away with quite different things, ideas of what it's doing, because we've had different experiences, we've focused on different parts of it. The generation of your own experience of something as a reader is where really it's not just reading about something that happened, it's making the thing happen yourself. And for me, that's like getting the reader sort of holistically involved in the experience. And so there will be mind, body, social, material sort of aspects to that, and not just through reading. Not to say that reading can't evoke, a lot of emotions. I mean, the whole point of literature is exactly that. But since our research articles are usually not aiming at eliciting feelings from their readers, they do, in a sense, block out one aspect of the possibility of being able to understand what happened. And my way of working with that idea, which I talk about in the methodology section, it comes from Stephen Chapin's interpretation of Robert Boyle's, who is a scientist working in the 17th century, and who is trying, he's working in on the air pump and experiments with the air pump, which is a very big machine. Not everybody can actually try the experiment out themselves. So he has to figure out a way to convince other people that what he did actually happened, and should try to understand what might have happened. And Chapin calls this virtual witnessing. So you as a reader, you're sort of witnessing the fact that something happened, even though you weren't there yourself. And that's how we try to be credible. And we do that in our research articles too, right? We try to be credible by saying, this is what the classroom looked like, this is, who the kids were, and this is what happened. And transcripts are really good because they look very credible. And we assume people don't make stuff up, and so on. So I wanted to push that idea of what would be adequate virtual witnessing in this case. And for me, reading about something that happened was no longer adequate, because I wanted you to actually do what happened as well.
I'm curious what just because this article is a different sort of thing than at least I've read, and I know you've been working on these ideas for a while, but like you say in the article, you're experimenting with some stuff and trying it out and trying to push some boundaries. What was a key challenge or like a main challenge in putting this article together? I imagine it couldn't have been just smooth sailing the whole way.
Yep, I mean, don't tell anybody this. An article I wrote in like a month, which like never happens. It always takes me months and months and months, because it was just all waiting to come out. But I guess I did play around a lot with selecting the images and selecting the sequence of images. What's really going to work? And asking, my students and stuff, like, try this out. What did you do when you tried it out? Did the instructions make sense? So that part, which I think is an important part to focus on. And one could write a whole paper on the methodology of that method, and how you choose those images. And I think more research would need to be done on this. What images actually work. Like Anna said, too bad that we can't put those animated GIFs in our papers, because that would be like re really very powerful. And that like brings to mind, the fact that our journal articles are also a technology that have focused on ancient ways of communicating, and have been very reluctant to allow us to work with videos. That's one problem. And then the other problem is issues that we have around navigating ethical concerns around sharing our videos. And so it's interesting that, in a way, this what I'm trying to call like embodied validity is clashing with, ethical questions that we might have. And so I think that's an interesting thing for us to think about. But the answer isn't, okay, well, let's just do things like how we always have done them in the past, because I think we need to keep trying to push and think about what other directions we can go in. I mean, I think people like Dan Chazen and Patricio Herp's work, making those animated films, that was a really clever way of trying to keep the motion and the vitality there, without representing people, particular people. So maybe that's like an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, and just following along with that, are there other takeaways or other ideas that you hope come out from this article into the field? We've talked about how the reader will have the experience of the article themselves, but then are there also more ideas like this of things that you think our field should be sort of pursuing and trying out or experimenting with in the future?
Recently, with Anna Boccolini Frank, we've been doing reenactments, but more part of the way to direct our own attention to what's going on and realizing how much, unless we like slow down and actually do what happened, even like me, who's just written a whole paper about this, ends up focusing on the words and the symbols and so on. At the very least, if this was an extreme example of reenactment, I think that maybe, I can imagine other people sort of taking it up as part of their, process of analyzing data. And in fact, Ricardo Nemirovsky and his colleagues, Rogers Hall and other colleagues that I mentioned in the paper, they have been doing that, but they haven't been writing explicitly about it in papers. So that's one direction. Another direction that I'm very interested in is the whole question of, how can I, a middle-aged white woman, be reenacting a 4-year-old girl who lives in a completely different community and maybe even uses a different language? And what are the issues around that? What are the opportunities around that? How can we learn about other people by being other people? And what are the dangers of imposing sort of our own lived experiences on others? So I think that's interesting. And again, here are some sort of ethical questions that are coming out of just trying to be a little bit more experiential, I guess, or voluptuous, as Patti Lather would say. So I think that's an interesting question. And it also, in doing this work, I've realized how we actually do that all the time. Even when we're reading a transcript, we're trying to understand something that we can only really understand from our own perspective and impose it on, what other people have done. So even though this dramatizes that by like reenacting the person, it points to something that we all do, even in our regular sort of forms of transcribing and so on.
My guest is Natalie Sinclair, and Natalie, thanks so much for this work. It is kind of fascinating, fun to play with, and it's kind of mind expanding if I go back into the mind, which probably is the wrong way to wrap that conversation up, but it is fun. And also kudos to the Digital Experiences in Mathematics Education, a journal I know that's close to your heart, but also cool that they are, publishing this sort of work that's pushing the field a little bit. So I encourage people to check out Digital Experiences in Math Education if they haven't yet. I have a couple more questions I want to ask before I let you go. So, first of all, just to help sort of place people and get a little bit of background, I was curious where you did your grad studies, and maybe just briefly, if you want to mention what your dissertation was and who advised you as you were doing that work.
Okay, I did my PhD at Queen's University, which is in Kingston, Ontario, in Canada. And I had Bill Higginson as my primary supervisor and Peter Taylor in the math department as a supervisor as well. And my dissertation was on the role of aesthetics in mathematical thinking and learning. And I looked at mathematicians, but also children. And that work was very close to my heart, but also one that I encountered a lot of roadblocks with, because people always thought aesthetics means, oh, that's for gifted people. And it's basically taken me like 20 years to be able to come back to that work and be able to talk about it in different ways, because I had to figure out a way to talk about it that wasn't interpreted in these sort of elitist ways. And in fact, it's by coming to the senses and to the ancient Greek etymology of aesthetics, of knowing with your senses, that I was able to connect back that old dissertation work with some of my new interests.
My last question is just a fun one. It's to imagine if you weren't in math education, is there another career that, is in the realm of possibility or just fun to think about?
I'm not sure. Like, I never really thought about what I was going to do, but there was a point. I mean, when I was young, I was like, architecture seemed like something really interesting, but I'm sure lots of people think that. I think maybe I might have been gone into translation. I really love words, and I'm a French speaker as my first language, and it's always interesting, I think, when you have more than one language, you notice things about the quirkiness of languages, the things that are translate well and the things that are untranslatable, and that's always very fascinating to me.
I have some doctoral students that were working on mathematics curriculum right now, and so they were looking for some textbooks that they might analyze for this curriculum class, and they found one they were kind of interested in, and they opened it up and it was in French. And I was
Oh.
saying, like, it's not my intention that you have to learn another language to do this assignment, but if you want to, it might be fun.
Yeah. Well, so it's a fr like a French textbook from France.
Well,
Well, that's
it's in our textbook collection here, and it just ha we've
oh.
got a we got some French books in our collection. I don't know where it's originated from, but
Well, we'll have to talk some more because with a PhD student of mine and Anna, we're looking at textbooks on multiplication in Italy, Turkey, and Canada. And so looking at that, the different cultural thing, but the linguistic stuff that comes along. So
right.
just starting that, I need to consult with you, I think, on
No, that's cool. Well, we'll
how to do
look for that work next, but thanks so much for speaking with us. It was really great to have the conversation.
Thanks, Sam.